From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the Supreme Court considers whether federal labor protections extend to LGBTQ workers.
It's a scary time for a lot of LGBT folks, and I think particularly for transgender folks, and that basically is trying to roll back a right that we've had in place for decades.
Also today, the state of the Massachusetts Republican Party.
We certainly do have our divergences of opinion, but we're still within one big political family, and we'd like to keep it that way.
We'll take stock and take your calls. And what does South Park have to do with sports?
I want to get away from that farm more than anything, but it's not worth living in a world where China controls my country's art.
We'll explore that and other major stories from the sports world. That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments today on a big question, one with major implications for U.S. workers. They're weighing whether federal civil rights law protects LGBTQ workers from workplace discrimination. For analysis, let's turn to WBUR senior news correspondent Kimberly Atkins, who was at the oral arguments today. Kimberly, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, Tiziana.
Hi there. So, Kimberly, what was at the heart of today's arguments?
Well, at the heart of it is the Title VII of the Federal Civil Rights Act of 1964, which people know prohibits discrimination on the basis of things like sex and race and other protected classes. Today, the court considered two sets of cases. One asked whether the prohibition of discrimination on the basis of sex extends to sexual orientation, whether federal law prohibits people from being fired because they are gay or lesbian. The second set of cases involved that same question, but it involved transgender employees, whether that statute applies to them too.
So, Kimberly, you said there were two cases. Can you walk us through the main points for the lawyers arguing in both cases that these federal protections do extend both to sexual orientation and to transgender workers?
Well, the arguments in both were pretty straightforward and pretty similar. Essentially, the people representing these employees said, look, when you discriminate against someone because of their sexual orientation or because of their gender identity, you are, under the language of this statute, discriminating, quote, because of sex. That's what the statute says, and it necessarily applies in these cases because if, for example, a man who is gay is fired because of that, he's being treated differently than a woman in that same position who is also either in a relationship with or is attracted to men. The only difference between those two cases is that one is a man and one is a woman. That difference is sex. And the same thing for transgender employees. If somebody is identifying as a woman and that causes them to lose her job, in that case, if it was someone who otherwise, before they made a change in their identification, if their job was fine, then the only thing that has changed is that individual's sex, and that falls under Title VII. Of course, the employers disagreed, and they were backed up by the Trump administration attorney, who also saw things differently.
So we talked earlier today with Jansen Wu. He's the executive director of GLAAD. They do legal advocacy for the LGBTQ community and people living with HIV in New England. He underscored this argument that the 1964 Civil Rights Act clearly covers people's sexual orientation.
There's simply no way to fire somebody because they're a man who is attracted to other men, even though you would not have fired somebody who is a woman attracted to other men, without taking into account their sex.
You pointed out that the government is arguing against. So what is the counter argument to that assertion that we heard in court today?
Well, essentially, the employers and the government attorney, that the Solicitor General who is backing the employer's argument, say, look, when the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was passed, the lawmakers who passed that act did not anticipate that it would apply to people who were gay, or did not anticipate that it would apply to claims of transgender discrimination. There's nothing in the history of that act that shows that. They were talking about discrimination, treating a woman differently than a man, or vice versa, in a very straightforward way, and that the court, if it were to broaden its interpretation to include sexual orientation or gender identity, would be overstepping the bounds that are really left in the realm of the legislature. The court would be overreaching.
Kimberly, these are momentous cases. This is a big day in the Supreme Court. Were there any moments that really stood out?
Yeah, there were a couple. I mean, at one point, Justice Sonia Sotomayor really went beyond the law of this and talked about the fact that this is a kind of discrimination that can be really awful to people, that people are beaten and really put in danger because of their sexual orientation or their sexual identity. Also, one of the conservative justices, Justice Neil Gorsuch, who was an appointee by Donald Trump, said that this was a close case. You know, this is something that the court is expected to be divided along ideological lines. But he said on the one hand that on the statutory issue, it's close. But on the other hand, he made it really clear that he's uncomfortable with the court making a ruling that he said could lead to, quote, social upheaval if the court starts stepping in where the legislature could go. It also, the day also started out with some suspicious packages outside the court, which really caused the court to be a very different than usual. Protesters had to be shuttled away to another part of the corner near where the Supreme Court is. There were a lot of police cars around, and it was difficult for us to even get into the court. So it was a lot of drama and excitement on the outside. One last thing, Laverne Cox, the actress from Orange is the New Black, who has been very outspoken on these issues, she was in the court. She was present.
And Laverne Cox is a transgender actress. And that does that, you know, that you said drama, some excitement. We spoke today with Treyandre Valentine, who is the executive director of the Massachusetts Transgender Political Coalition, about the cases. Here is what he said to us.
It's a scary time for a lot of LGBT folks, and I think particularly for transgender folks, and that basically is trying to roll back rights that we've had in place for decades. So it is quite concerning.
Was there a sense of real concern and anxiety in the courtroom today among advocates, Kimberly?
Not in the courtroom. I mean, certainly outside where the protesters were, there was a lot of chanting and a lot of energy and emotion. Within the Supreme Court, it's a very staid and somber place. So it was really a focus on the law, making these very, sometimes very nuanced legal arguments within the courtroom. It was very quiet.
You mentioned Justices Sotomayor and Gorsuch. The balance of the power on the court has shifted. Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote the majority opinions in all four of the court's sort of major decisions protecting gay and lesbian people, including the 2015 ruling that established a constitutional right to same-sex marriage. He's gone, replaced by Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Do you feel like this change in the balance of power was reflected in the courtroom and in the questions that were being asked today?
Not really today. I mean, Justice Kavanaugh only asked one question, and it was a really technical question about the text of the statute. So it really didn't give anyone there any sense of where he is leaning. Certainly, it didn't make him seem like the new Kennedy and someone who can step in and really very carefully advance rights within the LGBTQ realm. And aside from the one comment from Gorsuch, which has gotten a lot of chatter lately when he called this case close, I think we can really expect this to be a close case and really divided along the court's ideological lines, whether one of the more conservative justices will find some room to allow this statute to apply to gender identity and to sexual orientation. I think we'll have to wait and see.
That is WBUR senior news correspondent Kimberly Atkins. Kimberly, thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
Let's add some legal perspective. We're going to bring in Rosanna Cavallaro. She's a professor at Suffolk University Law School. Rosanna, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Okay, let me just start by asking you, how do you interpret what happened in the court today?
Well, I think there are clues there that we don't want to overread, but we do have a report of Justice Gorsuch saying, but isn't sex at least in play here, and might that not be enough? So that, in addition to what you already observed, him describing it as maybe a close case, gives a little bit of hope to those who are wanting this more expansive reading of Title VII. But we also have him flagging the idea of social upheaval as a reason for not reading that term expansively. So I think we can't predict.
Social upheaval meaning that the court would create social upheaval if it chose to read the term expansively?
I assume that's what he was referring to, which is obviously sort of a troubling thing to throw into the mix. I mean, if the law requires this relief, then it requires it just as it did with Brown versus Board of Ed, or just as it did with Obergefell, the gay marriage case. I mean, there was a danger, if you want to characterize it that way, of people being unhappy with a court recognizing those rights. But, you know, those are the rights then the Constitution provides them. Here it's statutory, not constitutional, but we take that as it comes. It's not a reason not to do it.
So it sounds like you don't think that's a fair or appropriate consideration for the justices to use in making their final decision on this.
No, definitely not. And I think the other piece here in terms of this sort of perfect storm is we not only have a new cast of justices, characters who are less inclined to read expansively and find the rights of gays and lesbians and trans persons, but they're also relatively conservative in terms of taking a term from a statute and stretching it to fit evolving understandings. So if the word is sex, Justice Gorsuch has said, well, we're going to interpret that, or we ought to interpret that, as it was understood at the time it was enacted, which is 1964. We today, of course, understand sex as a gender, as encompassing gender identity, sexual orientation, gender expression, but there's a strong motif there in 1964 understanding that it's biology and nothing beyond biology, which would mean a very different outcome in this case.
How big of a deal is this case? What's at stake?
Well, I mean, to obviously for gay and lesbian and trans people, it's an enormous thing that's at stake, and I think Justice Sotomayor adverted to that and placed it in this larger context of just what it means to be able to fire someone just because of who they are in the sense of their sexual orientation, that they are gay. They can lose their job. That's a terrible thing, and it's something that we want to be able to say should never happen. I think the question is whether the court is going to step up and say that cannot happen, or whether the court is going to punt and say it's not for us, it's for the legislature, it's for Congress. They need to add to the protections they've already created. They need to add to that list sexual orientation because of the centrality of that need for protection.
You just essentially noted part of the Trump administration's argument here, which is that this is better handled by Congress than the Supreme Court. Is there any merit to that argument in your mind?
Well, I mean, I think reasonable people can differ about that. My own view is that that's what the court is there for, is to make sure that the understanding of these statutory terms is appropriate and as expansive as it ought properly to be. But there are certainly people who say that these are really different institutional competencies, that if there is a popular will to recognize this protection, then it will be represented in an act of Congress. And so that's the tension there, whether the court will say that's what sex means. When Congress spoke in 1964, they meant that you can never consider a person's gender when you're making the decisions at issue here, employment decisions. If you're considering it in any way, then there's a remedy. It's already there.
I'm curious, historically, who tends to push the bounds of rights first? Is it the court in its findings, or is it Congress with legislation?
Well, that's a very nice question. I mean, I think we think of it as a back and forth. It always depends on the context, that there are times when Congress is pushing ahead and defining protections that have not been recognized by the court as yet. And then there's times when the court says, you know, Congress, you haven't moved quickly enough. And so we're going to say that, you know, for example, separate but equal is not equal. And so we're going to fix it. And I think we're in a time of tremendous social transformation, all to the good. And we're wondering now whether we have the right constituency on the court for the court to move ahead of Congress. Those statutes are apparently, there are statutes pending right now in Congress that would expand Title VII, make explicit what we now are sort of digging into the word sex to accomplish. They have not been passed yet. They're not likely to be passed under this administration. So it's right now in the hands of the court.
If the court were to decide that the Civil Rights Act does in fact offer protections to LGBTQ workers, what would the impact be here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts?
Well, I mean, obviously that would mean that people could state a claim without saying anything beyond that. I think that a number of states have already recognized that protection and that right. That's part of why they're saying, well, obviously it can't be in the federal statute. Otherwise, why would states be creating that protection? That's not needed. So I think Massachusetts, relatively speaking, people are in a good protected position. But the other sort of fallout that may or may not evolve is that there's this sort of sense that religious groups, religiously affiliated employers may feel that if they're told they cannot make hiring, firing decisions based on sexual orientation, that that would then infringe their religious liberties. And so we throw another interest into the mix.
Rosanna Cavallaro, professor at Suffolk University Law School, thanks so much for joining us on Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, is there a rift in the Massachusetts Republican Party? We'll explore it. I'm Tisiana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tisiana Deering. Over the weekend, a member of the Massachusetts Republican State Committee wrote an opinion piece in the Lowell Sun that took aim at establishment Republicans, referring to them as rats. The author, Brian Genest, who was a member of the committee, also accused past leaders of the state GOP, those associated with Governor Charlie Baker, of directing political funds away from Republican candidates. It's the latest sign of what looks like rifts within the Massachusetts Republican Party, which is also divided over President Trump. So today we want to take stock of the Massachusetts GOP, of the relationship between the governor and party leadership, and of what it means to be a conservative in the Commonwealth. Joining me now to do that is Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican activist and a political writer. Ed, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us in studio is Jennifer Braceras, columnist and director of the Independent Women's Law Center. Jennifer, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
And how about you? Are you a Republican in Massachusetts? What is the state of the party? Do you think there's an internal rift? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Okay, Ed, let's start with you. What's your reaction to the op-ed?
It was disgraceful. That should never have been run by the Sun. It was inaccurate. And the author ended up lying about this candidate not getting support when she did. The split in the party is very bad, and it's causing much more damage than in the past.
So this seems, Ed, like a struggle between old and new. From your perspective, how would you characterize the relationship between Baker, Baker supporters, and the current Massachusetts GOP?
Not good. I think that once the Jim Lyons crew took over the state party, in terms of the money and the messaging, that things kind of went downhill. The fact that they want to go back and find fault with what the previous administration did is not a good thing. The language they're using is bad. Their fundraising numbers are in trouble right now, and that's going to hurt our candidates. And they are putting out a kind of messaging that is harming our ability to have the public take us seriously, headed for this massive blue wave again a year from now. So it's very bad, and I think people who view Baker as our party leader are really worried the fact that this is going to really hurt our ability to get more people into office.
And just for our readers' sake, just so they understand, you, Ed Lyons, are not related to Jim Lyons.
No.
These are two separate people. So, Jennifer, you identify as an independent politically, but you have supported some Republican politicians. What is your view on all of this and what's going on?
So I used to be a Republican. I'm fairly recently unenrolled, like a lot of people in Massachusetts. And I think that's a big piece of this, is that the unenrolled portion of the electorate in Massachusetts has been growing over many years. And so this infighting amongst Republicans, which we've had for a very long time, has become more intense because it's a smaller group now. And I think oftentimes political disagreements can be very intense when, you know, it's a smaller group of people. But I go back to during the Bush administration. I was actually working in the White House at the time, and I was not a Massachusetts resident then. I was actually enrolled in Connecticut, where I grew up, and that's where I voted. But I had quite a few friends who were Massachusetts residents and voted in Massachusetts. And this was at the time when Bill Weld was running against John Silver. And on the face of it, all of these conservatives said they were for Bill Weld. And every single one of them told me they sent in their absentee ballots for John Silver. So there has always been a split, in my memory, between the conservatives in the Mass GOP, who sometimes don't even support their own candidates, and the more moderate to liberal Republicans like Charlie Baker or Bill Weld.
Listeners, join this conversation. Are you a conservative in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts? Are you a Republican in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts? Are those the same thing or not? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. At Governor Baker polls very well in the Commonwealth across a variety of categories. He polls not as well as President Trump, but above 50% with Republicans, but with most other categories as well. Should he, as the Republican governor of the Commonwealth, be concerned if he is not aligned with the state party right now?
Sure, because he cares about the party. He's been a Republican his whole life. He kind of also is the party that, without Charlie Baker, we're not really a viable statewide organization anymore. Parties can die. We could be like the Rhode Island GOP or the, you know, the California GOP is on life support. We could stop being a policy-making organization and just be a bunch of angry people fighting over a tiny number of state legislative seats. That he is concerned also because if he goes for a third term, he's indicated interest in a third term, that he can't have the party be against him. I mean, he lost a third of the vote to Scott Lively. It's not impossible to imagine him losing to a better candidate than that if he runs again. So
this was during the Republican primary in the last election.
Last time, yeah, right. So it's like the state loves him, but the base kind of doesn't love him. So, he has to be concerned if he wants to run again, then he has to keep the party behind him to some degree.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Pat from Watertown, what's on your mind?
Hi. I am not a Republican, but a lot of my work takes me to, town fair kinds of events where there's a lot of political, booths and the parties and various other community organizations. And what I've noticed recently, I was at the Watertown Fair last weekend, and the sign in front of the Republican booth, the Democratic booth was, younger and, very normal, what you'd think if you follow politics. And there was a big sign at the Republican booth, we are the Republican wing of the Republican Party. So it seems like the boots on the ground are very much in the, at least anecdotally, are very much in the Trump corner and not in the Baker corner.
Thanks for that, Pat.
Yeah,
Jennifer,
I mean,
go ahead.
Let's remember that Trump won the Massachusetts Republican primary, and he continues to have a lot of support amongst Republicans in the state, even those who didn't vote for him in the primary, who were like Jim Lyons himself, I believe, was originally had publicly endorsed Ted Cruz. And now, he's a fairly strong supporter of the president. So I do see that support quite strong amongst Republicans in the state.
So I want to bring another voice in. We spoke earlier with Tom Mountain. He's a member of the State Republican Committee from Middlesex and Norfolk and the chair of the Newton Republican City Committee. He's also a Massachusetts Trump campaign liaison. I want to play a piece of our conversation, starting with his reaction to the op-ed that we mentioned earlier from his fellow committee man that implied establishment Republicans in the state were rats.
Well, I would certainly take issue with that. I don't concur with my colleague on that, although I do certainly like him and respect him. But I would say that like any big Republican, like any big family, political or otherwise, we certainly do have our divergences of opinion. And we have some Republicans who are more, shall we say, to the liberal side, some more to the conservative side. But we're still within one big political family. And we'd like to keep it that way.
So, Tom, it's interesting. From the outside, it would appear, especially in reading media reports, it would appear that there's a substantial rift inside the Massachusetts Republican State Party. Is that a mischaracterization? Are you saying there aren't tensions and a rift inside the party?
Well, there's always challenges within any huge political entity, which the Republican Party of Massachusetts certainly is, and we have a divergence of opinion. And, should you or anyone come to our state committee meetings, you'd see that immediately. There will always be as there are in the National Republican Party, between, say, Mitt Romney and President Trump, there will always be a divergence of opinion. For people to characterize it as something akin to a severe internal squabbling, it's just really not the case.
So, listeners, what do you think? Is the mass GOP still one family? Republican or Democrat or independent, in your mind, how important are healthy state parties to the political process, to legislating, to office holders, et cetera? Call us. Tell us what you think. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Ed, what do you make of Tom Mountain's characterization of sort of the state of the mass GOP?
It's all nonsense, of course.
Well, I mean, he's inside the party structure, and he's saying it's not nonsense. This is a guy saying we can keep these tensions together as a single family. So why do you call that nonsense?
Well, I mean, look at what we've seen just in the Boston Globe alone in terms of the fight over the fundraising. Baker has segregated this entire operation. Merrimack Street, where the party headquarters is, used to be a collaboration between the governor and the party in terms of fundraising, all kinds of other activities. That's now completely separated out. They're running out of money there. things are much worse than the papers are indicating. I know it's in the interest of the conservatives who have captured the party to indicate everything is fine now, but of course it's in their interest to say that when everything is not fine. The fact that they want to go after the previous office holder at Merrimack Street with all these audits things means the fact that I don't think they really see us as all one family, and I'm certainly not in Tom Mountain's family.
So the previous officer holder in Merrimack Street, that's a reference to the former chair of
Kirsten Hughes, right, and her staff and all the fundraisers who work there. That's saying that they were all wasting money and all that. So I think they're going after them. That doesn't do anything for the party.
So, Jennifer, in listening to Tom Mountain's comments, one could think this is somebody who is trying very hard to hold everyone together. What were your reactions in listening to how he was talking about sort of the state and the health of the mass GOP?
I think he's right in the sense the parties are always a big tent ideologically in terms of what people believe. But in this particular case, I have to agree with Ed. I think that he's papering over some very real divisions. And look, there were a lot of candidates on down-ballot races that felt, rightly or wrongly, that they did not get sufficient support from Governor Baker and his team and from the state party last time around. They felt they had some winnable races.
Is that fair?
Well, I mean, they say, you know, the governor didn't campaign with them, didn't cut ads for them. They didn't get as much money as they could have gotten from the party. Most of it was going to the governor's campaign. I think all of those things are true. And so the differences and the split here is not just ideological. It's personal.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423. Call us and join the conversation. Ed, what about these criticisms that money needed to be taken back sort of from the former Baker Party establishment Republicans because it wasn't going to support Republican issues and Republican candidates?
What do you think raised all that money? It doesn't fall from the sky. Baker's people are fundraising geniuses. And their other donors were donating to a party managed by somebody they thought was competent and productive. So I think that to be angry about the money that they didn't raise, these candidates can raise their own money, and they do. And actually, many of them got support. You can look it up in the OCPF records, the fact that many of them got some support. And if you can't win, if you don't get another $3,000 from Merrimack Street, I'm sorry, you're not a viable candidate.
Well,
so
I think
we hear that all the time.
In all fairness, they would say that money that was donated to the party and not donated specifically to the Baker campaign should have been distributed more generously to candidates down ballot. And they would argue that Governor Baker spent a lot of time cutting ads with Democrats instead of cutting ads with them. Now, to Governor Baker's credit, that's how he won. He built a coalition with Democrats and independents, and that's his model for success. So, you know, that's what he felt he needed to do to win re-election. And I understand that as a political analyst. But I am telling you that the anger from the candidates who were coerced, not coerced, but coaxed into running with promises of help, felt that they did not receive it.
Let's take a call here. Cecilia from Quincy is on the line. Cecilia, go ahead.
Hi. I would just like to add to the conversation, as someone who is not a Republican, however, I watch politics very closely. At one point in time, I worked in politics at the State House. And I strongly feel that in Massachusetts, we've had some very interesting Republicans who have been governors. And frankly, I've been happy with every one of them, the last being Mitt Romney, who I thought was terrific. He brought the whole health care thing along. And I think that the division is within the Republican Party themselves, having animosity towards those that don't have a middle-of-the-road view.
Let's pick it up from there, Cecilia. Thanks for that call. Ed, we are a commonwealth that has been predominantly liberal or Democratic, but with a series of very successful Republican governors. How important are healthy parties on both sides to maintaining the kind of middle-of-the-road balance that the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, you know, to some extent, at least in state-level politics, has been known for?
Well, they are very important because they're supposed to be organizations that have long-term interests, that think broadly about the problems the state is going through, that cultivate candidates with the right kinds of ideas. It's very important. The problem is that a lot of people like Time Mountain believe a lot of things that no one's going to vote for. There are gateway issues on gay rights, on women's rights, on Donald Trump, and a whole bunch of other things where if you profess these views, no one's going to vote for you. Even Jim Lyons finally lost. So I just think that, like, the state needs a productive Republican Party, but to be productive, we need something kind of like Charlie Baker's politics, not like Tom Mountain or Jim Lyons' politics, right? It's not like what we believe is just some arbitrary thing. It's what are people actually going to vote for? We're not going to have a state party in a few years when Charlie Baker leaves if we don't believe anything that anyone else believes here. So we need to survive. That's what this comes down to.
So, listeners, we're going to start to transition into larger issues. President Trump, the impeachment inquiry, the state of the National Republican Party. Join us and share your thoughts. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jennifer, national issues do seem to be complicating the picture in the Commonwealth. You've talked about the change in enrollment for some conservatives, for example, from Republican to independent. How much of this change has to do with Donald Trump?
Some of it has to do with Donald Trump. I mean, there are people who unenrolled after the primary when he won it, and they felt that if the Republican Party in the state was for Trump, then it wasn't for them. I do know people who made that decision. But it also makes a lot of sense for voters to be unenrolled in this state because we have open primaries, and it really gives you an opportunity to vote in the primary that makes sense in any given election cycle. So, for example, you know, if there's an open seat for Congress, and you pretty much know that the Democratic candidate, whoever gets the nomination, will win the seat, you might choose, even as a conservative, to vote in the Democratic primary to try to influence who the party nominates, right? So, and you can decide election to election. I've voted in Democratic primaries. I've voted in Republican primaries. So given the way the system is structured, it actually makes sense for voters to be unenrolled. It gives you the greatest degree of choice.
So let's talk about the impeachment inquiry. Governor Baker said last Thursday that he thought some level of investigation was appropriate. He's not the only Republican to support the inquiry. There's a new Washington Post Schar School poll out today that says 28% of Republicans support the inquiry and 18% they support removing Trump from office. I'm going to come to the two of you about this, but I want to turn again to the conversation first that we had with Tom Mountain earlier today of the State Republican Committee and chair of the Newton Republican City Committee. Reminder, he's also a Mass Trump campaign liaison. He takes issues with the poll numbers.
First, I don't believe the polls. As one who was very active in the Trump campaign in 2016, had we believed in or adhered to polling, we would have lost the election. But just in terms of the impeachment hearing, the so-called impeachment hearing investigations, those will blow over in a matter of time because the premise upon which they're based is farcical. The entire impeachment scam, as we call it, is a joke. It's ridiculous.
So, Tom, you don't have any issue with the president's call to Volodymyr Zelensky in Ukraine asking him to investigate the Bidens?
Oh, none whatsoever. The Bidens need to be investigated totally. Presidents will make calls to international leaders all the time on various issues.
So, Ed, the president of the United States often does make calls to foreign leaders. That's always been the case, but not to benefit political campaigns. Is there something in your mind different going on here?
Yes, I think that this is very different. It's the reason why we've had this big change in interest. It's the reason why that the House Democrats have decided to start the impeachment inquiry. It's the reason why Charlie Baker has decided to support it. It's because something different has happened, and it's good that we're going to all explore this together.
The lines are filling up, so let's take a call. Sam from Wellesley, go ahead.
Hi. Hi, Ed. Hi, Jen. My name is Sam Garber. I'm the chairman of the Massachusetts Teenage Republicans. We are basically the high school auxiliary of the Mass GOP. And, you know, I want to talk a little bit about kind of how out of touch the current leadership of the party is with the next generation of the party. And, you know, we had this discussion with a lot of people after Jim Lyons became the chair of the party. And a lot of our members were incredibly alienated. They did not feel that it was a Big Tent party any longer. In fact, I heard of somebody the other day that has called the party to offer to donate to Governor Baker's campaign, and they were called a rat and told, you know, basically, you know, the establishment Republicans were not, you know, you can call the Baker campaign directly if you want to donate to the governor. We're working on Senate races and for President Trump.
Sam, we're gonna take it from there. Thank you. And it's fantastic to have the voice of a young person who's active in the state Republican Party. Jennifer, I'll turn to you there. This is a young person saying the state party has changed leadership. The new leadership is out of touch with young Republicans. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I think he has a point. But I also think that most young teenagers or new voters in college age, have no idea who the chairman of the Mass Republican Party is. They register in a party based on their views on issues, perhaps based on national leadership, who the president is, who their senators are, and whether or not they agree with them. And most people have no idea who runs the parties, and they're just not concerned about it at that granular level, unlike, you know, this young man who—
Sam, the caller.
Right, who obviously is very involved, and I commend him for that. I just don't think most teenagers, it impacts their decision as far as party affiliation is concerned.
So we're starting to run out of time. I want to get a couple more questions at the national level in. Ed, how important is how the impeachment inquiry unfolds in U.S. Congress to where the Massachusetts GOP is 12 months from now?
It's critical. Oh, first, hi, Sam. It's critical because, unfortunately, national politics is sort of this acid rain that's falling down into our state. It's affecting too many things. I think it's unfortunate. We should have federalism. We should not be constantly talking about national things. It's hurting the Dems, too, but it's hurting the Republicans much worse. And if you look at a lot of the press releases coming out of Jim Lyons' office, which, by the way, he email blasts everybody in the party. He's all the social. People know who his name is. That's half of it is national stuff, criticizing congresswomen, taking positions on things that have nothing to do with our state. So the Charlie Baker's Republicanism was much more focused on the state. They never mentioned national issues with the previous people who were in charge of the party. Now it's half of it or more is national issues. So, of course, they're going to go crazy because they need to raise money. And they brought up two Trump officials for a fundraiser last week to do like a fundraiser for their federal account. They are very focused on impeachment and national politics. We're going to see a lot more of it.
Jennifer, what's your thought?
I agree with that about the federal nature of our system. And, you know, a Republican in Massachusetts isn't going to look like a Republican in Alabama, and that's as it should be. I do think that this president is unique in terms of, you know, his ability to generate media attention and raise money. And therefore, I don't know that it's necessarily a bad idea for the state party to be focusing on national things. I personally wish they wouldn't. There are a lot of state and local issues and candidates that they could be cultivating and focusing on. But I'm not sure strategically it's necessarily a bad idea.
That is Jennifer Braceras, columnist and editor of the Independent Women's Law Center. Jennifer, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer. Ed, thanks for being on Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
Stay with us. Coming up, a dust-up between the NBA and China has raised some interesting questions about professional sports on an increasingly global stage. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering.
I want to get away from that farm more than anything, but it's not worth living in a world where China controls my country's art.
Yes, that is a clip from South Park, the latest episode, actually, which is called Banned in China. The episode took a critical look at the influence that China's Communist Party has had over Hollywood, as major studios and entertainment companies have started to shape content with a focus on expanding into Chinese markets. After it aired last week, Chinese censors responded by deleting every episode, clip, and even online discussion of the show as if it never existed. Now, I thought this was supposed to be a sports segment. With us to talk about it is Radio Boston's Chris Sitterick. Chris, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so how does this relate to sports?
So the NBA is finding itself with its own China problem right now, and they handled it very differently than South Park. The South Park creators posted a very sarcastic apology, and as you said, the show's basically been wiped from existence in China. So we'll take a step back. On Friday night, Houston Rockets general manager Daryl Morey tweeted, "Fight for freedom, stand with Hong Kong." He's since deleted that tweet, but the backlash was pretty quick. Over the weekend, the Chinese Basketball Association suspended its relationship with the Houston Rockets. They've announced that the two preseason games that were supposed to be played there this week would not take place. They've blocked online merchandise sites for the NBA. And so the NBA was slow to respond, but then eventually put out a statement, and here's what it read. Here's how it read. "We recognize that the views expressed by Houston Rockets general manager Daryl Morey have deeply offended many of our friends and fans in China, which is regrettable. While Daryl has made it clear this tweet does not represent the Rockets or the NBA, the values of the league support individuals educating themselves and sharing their views on matters important to them. We have great respect for the history and culture of China."
Okay.
So pretty apologetic, and that obviously generated its own criticism from there. NBA Commissioner Adam Silver has started walking that back a little bit. Here he is at a news conference in Tokyo earlier today.
"I don't think it's inconsistent to both be apologetic that that was the outcome of that speech, but at the same time support Daryl's right, you know, to his freedom of expression."
So you can hear it in his voice. That's about as on the fence as somebody can get on
that. That
is
hardly
right?
An in-your-face sarcastic response like right. We might have heard from the South Park producers.
Yeah, and it's interesting. The NBA put out a lengthier statement today basically saying we value all diversity, including diversity of thought, as we hit the global market. And so you might think that the NBA would be quicker to stand by its people. That's not necessarily the case, and I think you'll be able to tell why. I want to play a little more from Adam Silver earlier today.
"There are consequences from that exercise of, in essence, his freedom of speech. And, you know, we will have to live with those consequences. It's my hope that for our Chinese fans and our partners in China, they will see those remarks in the context of now a three-decade, if not longer, relationship."
Chris, in listening to him, that's so striking. That is so tortured.
Yeah.
So what is going on?
Well, can you guess what he means by consequences?
Financial?
Yeah, absolutely. You're talking about a huge, huge market. And the Rockets specifically have a huge audience in China anyway. That's the franchise that drafted and signed Yao Ming back in 2002. The numbers don't lie. You've got 640 million viewers in China tuned in at some point during the 2017-2018 season. These are according to the league. 21 million people watched the final game of the 2019 finals. That's more than watched it here in the U.S.
I had no idea.
So you're talking about a massive audience and incredible amount of money basically on the line here.
So it's so – okay, we're in the middle of football season. So we've been paying attention to the NFL, and part of – what strikes me about this is I guess I perceived that the NBA was much more open to social and political activism from its players and its league than, say, the NFL. So this is a surprise.
Yeah, you're not alone there. The NBA has generally allowed its players and personnel to be more outspoken politically and socially. And a lot of people say that that is in response to the Trump administration. And it's true that there hasn't been a championship team that's visited the White House since President Trump took over. But it actually predates that. You had Carmelo Anthony marching in Baltimore in 2015 after Freddie Gray's death. You had a number of the most high-profile players in the sport wearing I Can't Breathe t-shirts after Eric Garner's death in 2014. The Miami Heat wore hoodies in 2012 in support of Trayvon Martin after his death. So this is a long-standing tradition in the NBA, but it does seem like Daryl Morey found something the league isn't quite as willing to accept. There have been some players weighing in, and I think it's really interesting to point out where they're landing on this issue. The Rockets' James Harden and Russell Westbrook were in Tokyo yesterday, and they spoke with reporters after a practice.
"Yeah, we apologize. You know, we love China. We love, you know, playing there. I know for both of us individually, we go there, you know, once or twice a year. They show us the most important love. So, you know, we appreciate them as a fan base.
So that's James Harden basically saying we love everything about China. He has his own brand there. There are shoe endorsement deals. And a lot of these high-profile players now are traveling to China once or twice a year to promote their financial interests as well.
So it sounds like the summary of this story is it's financially complicated, and therefore the NBA is experiencing it as tricky.
Yeah, I think that it's a real gray area for them, and it's going to be interesting to see what happens. This issue is not going away anytime soon, and we'll see what happens. I will say, Daryl Morey, arguably the best GM in the sports. I think that's part of why there wasn't any discussion of whether or not he would lose his job over this. If it's a different GM on a different organization, it's possible he would have been fired immediately.
All right, so before we leave the NBA, it's not the only NBA and politics story right now. I want to ask you about another from this weekend. Recently acquired Celtics center, I'm going to have trouble pronouncing his name. Maybe I'll let you do that part for
me. Enes Kanter, yeah.
Says he was harassed outside a mosque in Cambridge. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so I want to preface this by saying Cambridge police put out a statement today saying that there was no criminal activity, but that Kanter could seek restraining order if he so desired. Basically, Kanter was coming out of the Islamic Society of Boston. It's a mosque near Inman Square where he attends prayer service. And he posted a video on social media of two guys who were waiting for him when he came out. And he says they yelled and screamed at him aggressively, called him a traitor. And it's not the first time that he's had this kind of significant controversy or pushback. He's been very outspoken about Turkish President Erdogan. He's compared him to a modern-day Hitler. And he's had a lot of kind of dicey calls. He was actually detained at a Romanian airport in 2017, had his Turkish passport revoked. So he's no stranger to being confronted over his political stance.
It comes at an interesting time. Turkey, obviously, very much in the news this week after President Trump decided to withdraw U.S. troops from Syria in advance of a Turkish offensive against Kurds.
Right.
Do you expect that Kanter's going to continue to speak out after an event like this, given that Turkey is so firmly in the public eye right now?
Yeah, if you know anything about this guy, absolutely he's going to keep speaking out. He's been in the league for 8 years, and as I said, he's no stranger to the controversy that his comments generate. He actually, in recent years, has stopped traveling when the teams he's playing for goes to places like Toronto or London, where he would have to leave the country. He now actually stays home.
Why?
He's afraid he's going to be killed or attacked.
Wow.
So that shows you kind of what he's dealing with. But he said that he's not specifically not going to stop speaking up because of the things he's standing up for.
I'm talking about democracy, freedom of speech, religion and expression. I'm talking about justice. So just because of I'm talking about these issues, those stuff that I'm going to get threats, I'll take that.
So that's Kanter speaking with reporters after this latest incident. I do want to add, this is a guy who doesn't just say things, take political stances verbally. He also actually is really invested in the community. He gave an interview at the end of last year. He was playing for Portland at the time. He was struck by players saying in the offseason they were going to play a ton of Fortnite or go to the beach. And he said, we have such a platform and such a way to reach so many people. He decided he wanted to hold the most camps ever held by an athlete. He held 50 free basketball camps across the country in 30 different states this year. He said he's going to go for 60 camps in 40 states next year.
All right. Before we run out of time, I do want to ask you at least one question about the one Boston team not playing right now.
Okay.
I saw an article in the Globe called What Can the Red Sox Get If They Trade Mookie Betts? And I wanted to say, what?
Yeah.
What? Trade Mookie Betts?
Yeah, it's a real possibility, unfortunately.
No.
I think we all would love to see Mookie Betts sign here long term.
Yes.
You're talking about a franchise, once in a generation type talent. He's 27 years old, right in his peak. And even last year, which was a down year, he still had great numbers. The bottom line is this is an ownership that has shown they don't like to extend themselves financially. There's no salary cap in baseball, so you technically could spend as much money as you want to put whatever team on the field that you want. This Red Sox ownership has showed they like to stay under the luxury tax, which is a certain threshold that you have to pay a penalty if you go over. So now you're stuck. If you know you're not going to sign him long term, then you're stuck with the question, do we play out his contract for one more year or do we try to trade him while we can still get something for him?
So what do you think is going to happen? Are the Red Sox going to trade Mookie Betts?
Oh, I hope not. even if they ride it out and just take one more year of him and try to contend for a title this year, I think that's the move. I am not so sure. They are definitely making calls and they're seeing what they can get for him. So we'll see.
All right. That is Radio Boston's Chris Siderick.
Chris, thanks for the time today.
Thanks for having me.
That is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.